This is Jim Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. And it's my pleasure to welcome, as part of our continuing podcast series, the Honorable Alex Kaczynski, a judge on the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and his former law clerk, Misha Saitlin, who's an associate at Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher. We're here to talk about criminal law today, and Judge Kaczynski and Misha caught our eye with a piece that they published in the Cato Institute's recently published book, In the Name of Justice, looking at the aims of criminal law, responding to the classic article by Henry Hart. And their article is provocatively titled, You're Probably a Federal Criminal. So I guess I'll start with you, Misha. What do you mean when you say we're probably federal criminals?
The average reader has likely committed one offense that would satisfy all the elements of a federal crime, probably a federal felony. In the article, we go through several pages of potential crimes the reader may have committed, from tax fraud to taking drugs to depriving their employer of the intangible right to honest services and whatnot. And this pretty much covers, we feel, most people.
So, Judge, I'll pass it over to you. What does this criminalization that's so sweeping do to the moral force of the criminal law as you see it?
Well, I think we should make it clear, if it's not already, that the fact that somebody, that a lot of people, maybe everybody may have committed a federal crime, doesn't mean that everybody's going to be charged or tried or convicted. But what it does do is give a great deal of discretion to federal criminal justice authorities if they want to go after somebody. And, you know, with everybody sort of potentially, if you dig deep enough, you know, potentially you would be able to find some violation of the criminal law, the idea that the government goes after the really bad people and the criminal law defines a group of people who are set aside from society because they break the rules, as opposed to the great majority who are law-abiding and therefore morally not culpable, that idea breaks down. And essentially, whether you're a criminal or not, winds up being a matter in the discretion of the government. And we think that's a dangerous thing, but I think it's also something that undermines the moral force of criminal law, which, after all, is the most severe sanction that society can impose upon one of its members.
I think that's certainly something a lot of us are worried about, Judge. Misha, you, with the judge in your piece, talk about various possible options that a prosecutor might pursue in deciding what type of enforcement to employ in enforcing the criminal law, since obviously, given scarce resources, the prosecutors can't enforce everything, and in fact, most of us are guilty of something. What are some of these types of enforcement rules, so to speak, that a prosecutor might employ, and what are the dangers behind each of them?
One technique that a prosecutor could employ would be, or a police officer, would be to just randomly enforce all the laws, just try to catch as many people as he can for any crime within the limited time resources. And in that case, then the deciding factor in whether one would retain their freedom, their ability to vote, and all the other things that come from being convicted would be luck. Now, obviously, this is not the way criminal law enforcement operates, and the other option would be a form of selective enforcement. That is, the police and prosecutors would attempt to pick out what they believe are the worst criminals, the ones that are perhaps the ones that are easiest to prove, the ones the public is most angry at the moment, whether that be particular crimes like, you know, corporate white-collar enforcement in the wake of the Enron scandal, or particularly famous people that perhaps the public would want to see gone after, from Al Capone to Elliot Spitzer. And Elliot Spitzer has been on both ends of that. And the danger of that, of the selective enforcement, is that law enforcement becomes subjective. It would be what a prosecutor or a prosecutor's office thinks are, quote, the worst crimes, who are the worst offenders, what that prosecutor or police officer believes the public wants at that particular moment. And this is the good prosecutors, that is the ones that are attempting to diligently enforce the law. Now, the final possibility, and by no means do I believe that this is anything but a small percentage of prosecutors and police officers, is malevolent enforcement. That is to say, a prosecutor or a police officer who wants to use the law for some personal purpose to go after a particular person. And in that case, if under a criminalized populace, or a mostly criminalized populace, the prosecutor can pick the target, dig through their lives, and find some genuine violation of federal law, and then, you know, if someone were to point a finger and say, you went after this guy, well, the prosecutor will just say, well, they're a federal criminal, you know, they shouldn't have committed that crime. And so those are generally the ways that a prosecutor facing a criminalized populace can operate, and none of them are particularly appealing.
So, Judge, you see, obviously, a lot of criminal cases that come up to the Ninth Circuit. I don't know what percentage of the docket that would be, but I certainly remember from my days clerking on the Second Circuit, it's quite a high percentage of the cases that reach the Court of Appeals level that are criminal cases. You know, how often do you see cases, would you say, that really bring some of these problems, that exemplify some of these problems you're talking about?
You know, it's a little bit difficult to tell because by the time we get cases, they wind up being, you know, neatly packaged, having usually involving guilty plea or trial, and we don't know many of the decisions that go into how somebody is selected for prosecution. We also, much as we see, you know, a good number of criminal cases, we certainly don't see everything or nearly everything. Much of what happens in the criminal law happens by way of consent. People generally don't go to trial. Generally, they will find some way of pleading out. And this is another sort of aspect of the problem, is that once the prosecutors decide there's a problem, and again, I join Misha in saying I think this malevolent prosecution is, yeah, it's probably very rare. I think prosecutors tend to have good motives and good intentions. And of course, good intentions don't always lead to good results. But I think at least honest intentions. But once they focus on somebody, there are so many ways of charging conduct and related conduct that for something that might, other times have been one crime leading to, you know, possible sentence convicted of 5 or 10 years, you could well be looking at 15, 20 crimes that are interlacing, and that realistically could, if convicted on everything, could lead to a life altering, an extended, you know, life in prison, 20 years, 25 years, 30 years. So the risk of going to trial when there are that many ways in which the jury could find you guilty of something, or that if the jury finds you guilty of everything, you know, that's the end of your life, it creates a great disincentive towards exercising your constitutional right to a jury trial. And that kind of thing, the overcharging of cases, or what looks to me like overcharging. Actually, we see that, you know, with some regularity. Now, you know, you never know exactly what it is that the prosecutor had on the table, and what, because, again, the cases we get, by the time we get them, they either have, you know, have a jury verdict, or you've had a guilty plea or something of that sort. Cases where somebody gets charged for essentially the same conduct, 5, 6, 7 or more crimes, are not at all uncommon. And the very availability of that many ways of charging for the same conduct, I think, winds up being a significant factor in keeping people from exercising or taking the risk of going to trial, even when they think they are.
I think that's a very important point. Those of us who've looked a lot, I've spent more time looking at the civil law, and clearly settlement rates are so high that just looking at published decisions that come out in the courts can give you a very skewed picture. And of course, here, the incentive to plea bargain in the criminal law is similarly very high. And in your article, you point to a number of factors such as lying to federal agents or money laundering charges or mail fraud charges or conspiracy charges, each of which can be used to ramp up the potential sentence if they're added on to the core offense that's being charged. So the criminal's really stuck in the accused criminal's really stuck in a hard position if he or she wants to fight this out. So I guess before we wrap up, I just want to ask each of you, if you've got an idea or ideas, you know, what can we do about this problem? I mean, what should we do, looking at this from a policy perspective, to try to fix this situation? Because it seems to me that we're really delegating a lot of authority that should vest in the legislature to prosecutors here, and that's troubling for those of us who believe in separation of powers and worry about misuses, even if not malevolent, of prosecutorial discretion.
I think our article concludes with the idea that the problem right now is very largely a public relations problem. That is to say, people don't see the issue. People continue to support politicians that enact more draconian laws, more sentences, more punishments, and so rather than scaling back the issue, it's getting worse. So part of the reason the article is titled as provocatively as it is so people wonder, is it a good idea to have a criminal law that makes most of us federal criminals? And after the public relations campaign, if there was a public relations change, that is to say more people thought it was a problem, then perhaps laws would be repealed, less laws would be enacted, and then the momentum would be in the right direction. But for example, Hart, who wrote the article, he believed that there should be some sort of constitutional amendment to limit these sorts of problems. But the problem with that is a constitutional amendment is very difficult to pass. And if people are electing politicians who want to make more criminal laws, it seems unlikely that they would support a constitutional amendment to wholesale limit them.
Anything to add, Judge?
I think this. I see this. I agree with Misha, but I see this part of an even broader problem, and that is the idea that we have come to believe in the latter part of the 20th century and carried forward in the 21st, is that law and courts can or must find a solution for every problem. And so, whenever something happens where people are disappointed or people are unhappy, the question becomes, what can the courts do? And more pointedly, why isn't the criminal law taking care of this? Why aren't these people being prosecuted? And, you know, this is a somewhat novel notion. It's one that we have come to be used to as because of the time in which we live. But there was a time when you did not expect everything that was perhaps not quite to your liking, or possibly even something that wasn't quite morally wrong, to be criminally sanctionable, or that it's something over which you can bring a lawsuit. And I think that our faith in the power of court and the power of trials and the power of juries to right all wrongs or all perceived wrongs in our society, I think, is misguided. And it's part of what leads us to what leads politicians to want to pass more laws, or more criminal laws, is, the public expects every wrong to have a remedy and every moral wrong to have a remedy in the criminal, let's hasten to pass more laws and so that the next time this counts won't get away with it. What I think the public must come to realize, and I think those of us in the profession should try to explain this, is that there are serious costs involved in this approach, that the solutions provided by a legal system to what essentially are social ills are not cost-free, that they involve significant costs. The costs are ultimately borne by us as a society and by individuals that are affected by those laws. And so long as people think, well, I'm not one of the people who's going to be affected. I'm going to get the benefit, but you know, I'm not at risk of bearing the cost. We will continue to get this clamoring for more law.
Well, I would like to thank both of you for being with us. I certainly agree with that final sentiment, Judge. This is again Jim Copeland for the Manhattan Institute with Judge Alec Kaczynski and Attorney Misha Saitlin. In addition to this podcast, our other podcasts in this series can be downloaded at the Manhattan Institute's webpage, www.manhattan-institute.org, or our legal web magazine, www.pointoflaw.com. And the full essay by the judge and Misha Saitlin can be found in, again, the book's called In the Name of Justice. It's published by the Cato Institute and available at their website.